You are listening to the Indefensive Plants podcast, a show designed to cure plant blindness around the globe. Support for Indefensive Plants comes from listener donations. If you would like to give your support to Indefensive Plants, please consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants. And together, we can help cure plant blindness one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How's everyone doing this week? Today, we're talking about yuccas. Many of you probably grow them. If not you, then maybe many people in your neighborhood do. Also, if you've ever been to Joshua trees are yuccas as well. But we're not talking necessarily about the diversity of this genus. What we are going to talk about is their pollination. Joining us today is Dr. Carrie Seagraves, an associate professor at Syracuse University, and her work on yucca pollination is going to blow your mind, because yuccas are kind of crazy in that department. Each species has evolved a mutualism with a specific subset of moths, and only those moths can pollinate these plants, because the moths themselves absolutely require them to complete their life cycle. I don't want to steal any of Dr. Seagraves' thunder, so let's just jump right into it. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Seagraves. I hope you enjoy. All right, Dr. Carrie Seagraves, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about you tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
All right. Well, I'm a faculty member in biology at Syracuse University, and I do a lot of things, but mostly I teach courses here, and then I also conduct research on interactions between species.
Right on. And obviously, this is a plant podcast, so I'm guessing at least some of those species are plants, correct?
Yeah, I actually study a lot of things, but plants are one of the key things.
Awesome. And so what brought you to where you're at today, or at least what got you interested in the kinds of questions you like to ask about coevolution among species and interactions? I mean, were you more of an animal person, more of a plant person growing up? How did this all come about?
Yeah, you know, I think I have to go all the way back to high school when I took a course in ecology. It was a really unusual class where we essentially spent the latter part of our day traveling to the local river and collecting stuff. So we collect plants and insects and fish, and we'd talk about, you know, basic ecological concepts. And that's where I sort of started and became interested actually mostly in plants and insects. It was from there I went on to college and decided to get a degree in biology and had a research opportunity that really spurred me into what I'm doing today.
That's really cool. So this is something that sort of hit early and stuck with you, which is, you know, I mean, a lot of people flounder a little bit trying to figure out what's going on, but it's those special moments where you have an incident or a class per se that really kind of ingrains it in you, and it just sticks with you ever since. So that's really cool that it was able to, you know, be shoehorned into an actual career studying these sorts of interactions.
Yeah, you know, I never would have dreamed it. I was always an outdoorsy kind of kid, and I loved walking in the forests. And, you know, I grew up in sort of a rural place in eastern Washington state, I should say, and hanging out with my grandparents in the woods and stuff like that, that just sort of, you know, I think I had already had a strong love for nature. But then when I started learning about ecology, I realized that I could actually probably do this for a living.
Yeah. And how many people really hear the word ecology in any in-depth context before they get to, say, college? It's not something you hear about in general high school curricula.
No, I don't think that, you know, it's in an introductory biology sort of lesson, but you're going to hear about global climate change right now and a few other things, but not to the context, in the context that we actually had.
Right on. So I first learned about your research through the lens of yucca, a plant that many listeners will probably be familiar with, or in fact, probably growing in their own landscapes. You know, when did you first learn of this group, this genus of plants? And I guess maybe it was through the other half of this story. It could have been the first. What was your introduction to the system?
The system itself came later, although I was aware of the plants for the same reason that you mentioned that many of the listeners might be, in the sense that my parents had some planted in their gardens. And they actually dislike the plants because they would spread really quickly and basically take over the flower bed. And so we often had conversations about how to get rid of them. And I think it's kind of funny that I study them now. But coming around to your question, it was in an undergraduate evolution course where I learned about this interaction for the first time. It's actually a textbook example of mutually beneficial interactions between species. So what yucca pollination basically is pretty well known.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, again, because they're such popular plants, there are really good examples of how to teach this to someone because of the interdependency of the yucca and its pollinator, which we'll get into in a little bit more detail. But it is kind of neat to think about this idea of plant blindness and how the public views the plant world is kind of either boring, static, or might as well just not exist outside of being this green backdrop. But here's a plant with a fascinating pollination mechanism, syndrome really, that couldn't exist without a moth and vice versa, that is often in our own backyards. This is something people can tangibly go out and see somewhere in their neighborhood.
Exactly. And, you know, you miss it because it happens at night. So who goes out and looks at their flowers at night? Nobody.
there might be a few listeners. No, I'm kidding. I do, but I understand what you're trying to say. Yeah, it's like that night shift. Everyone forgets it exists.
Exactly.
No, that's funny. So, okay, let's get into it. We've mentioned this as a textbook example of coevolutionary mechanisms. There's something strange going on with yuccas and moths. What is it?
So the most unique aspect of this is that the moths are not accidental pollinators. They're purposeful ones. So we call it active pollination. And the moths, they actually have special structures. They're extra mouth parts that no other moth or butterfly has. And they use these to purposefully collect pollen from one flower. They fly to another plant, and then they use that pollen to purposefully pollinate the next plant.
Oh, geez. And that's so outlandish if you really stop and think about it. Is most pollination, I'm assuming, is accidental or happenstance because of either reward systems or trickery. But this is an actual, like, picking up pollen and doing this on purpose. And like, as you mentioned, this moth has evolved specialized structures to do this. This is not accidental or coincidence. This is directed. And is this something that's widespread among plants and their pollinators, or is this pretty localized to a specific sets of syndromes?
Yeah, so active pollination has only evolved four times that we're aware of. That's a loose number, in four systems, I should say, maybe not four times. So we have three examples with moths and then an example with wasps. So figs are a classic one. Mm. So the fig that you eat and many, many other species of figs are purposefully pollinated by a wasp that has little pockets on the side of its body that it uses to store pollen, and it flies. The females, actually, in the species fly to fig. They have, it's this horrible pathway that they have to, like, figs are basically inside-out inflorescences. Mm-hmm. They're really weird. So it looks more like a fruit when you look at the fig flowers, the inflorescence, and the females have to crawl through this tiny little hole to get inside of there, and then they end their lives inside that fig. But they also do a very similar thing where they put pollen onto the flowers.
Jeez. And obviously, if we're talking purposeful pollination here, it's not altruistic. They don't believe, per se, in the success of this plant, but there's something driving them to do this. So what is the give and take in this? What's the reason for this purposeful pollination?
So in the end, the plant is gaining something, right, from all of this. It's getting pollinated, but it has to give up some of its seeds to do so. So what happens is, in all of these systems, is that the insects are also laying eggs. And those eggs develop into larvae that then feed on some of the seeds. Not all of them, but some.
Wow. So this is really a moth or a wasp. I mean, in the case of yucca, it's a moth that's purposefully pollinating this so that it can then lay eggs on the style or the ovaries or something. And then the offspring will then feed on that. I mean, that is just mind-blowing when you really stop to think about the intricacies of how something like this might evolve.
Yeah, and, you know, it makes these types of systems unique in the sense that they're completely dependent on one another. That's a little unusual too. So they're called obligate pollination mutualisms, where the plant isn't pollinated by anything else, and the yucca moths only use yuccas, for instance, for laying their eggs and, of course, for pollinating.
Right. And there isn't just one species of yucca out there. There are many. So how specific is this? Is it one class of moths doing this, one species, one genus? I mean, is it you find a different moth for every species of yucca that's out there?
It's almost one moth species per one yucca species.
Oh, my gosh.
But it's not quite that specialized. There are a few moths that have up to seven different host plant species, so seven different yuccas, and we actually have two genera of moths, but
wow,
they're closely related.
Okay, so this isn't like completely out of left field that two suddenly converged on this strategy.
No, it's fairly rare that, you know, such a complex behavior and, you know, these changes in the morphology or the shape of the mouth parts and all that, that's highly unusual. So it would be difficult for that to evolve.
Yeah, unusual indeed. And it is curious to think about, you know, specialists in this context, as it often makes organisms more vulnerable depending on what the background context of the environment and all that's going on. So from your perspective as a scientist, how do you begin to unwrap the complexities of this relationship and try to understand it from like this evolutionary perspective? Because it's like what we see today has already happened, and it's, you know, we don't have a time machine, unfortunately. So what do you do?
Yeah, so when we first started working on this system, what we needed to do was to sort out how both of the partners were related. What were their evolutionary relationships? Who's closely related to whom? And then we could start to map on from that sort of family tree, if you will. It's kind of complicated in the sense that, you know, we have different behaviors, slightly different behaviors in the moths. And so if you want to understand how those behaviors evolved, you need to understand the evolutionary relationships of those moths. And then we can also map on who they're using in terms of plants. And then, of course, vice versa. You know, what are the traits of the plants and how have those changed with respect to the insects that are pollinating them?
Right. So by knowing who the partners are, what their evolutionary relationships are, and how maybe some of these key characters or traits or behaviors change from one to another, you can kind of use all of those wonderful like molecular time clock techniques and phylogenies to sort of, maybe if I'm understanding this right, like connect the dots towards some sort of logical pathway that this might happen.
Right. And our ultimate goals was to understand how new species could form in this group, because, you know, if there's a group of plants out there and then they adopt this different pollinator, this unique pollinator, why do you need more than one species, or why are there more than one species of pollinator, and why eventually did it become so specialized?
Yeah. And so what are you finding? I mean, like, what do these, to date at least, I know there's always so many unknowns and uncertainties out there, but I mean, do you have a grasp? I mean, at this point, is it easy to talk about some of these connections and how, you know, maybe it might be driving specialization or diversification even? I mean, what kind of things have we been finding in this?
Yeah, so we're working on a project right now to test ideas about whether it was being a pollinator that made them diversify, the moths in particular. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I know we're talking a little bit more about moths than the plants.
It's okay.
The plant side of things is still fuzzy, and actually it's funny because yuccas can hybridize, and we're starting to learn that the species boundaries in yucca aren't very clear.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it's going to make this a little bit more complicated. But
darn plants.
From the moth side, they're only rarely hybridized, and so it's a little easier to work with and study. But what we've been interested in is whether the pollination side of the interaction is causing them to become new species, or whether it's the being a parasite of the plant, you know, the feeding on seeds part that is causing diversification or new species to form.
And that's an interesting perspective to take, because it gets at this, where did it even come in the first place? You know, how did this come to be? And you mentioned the word parasite, which in reality, if I hear something's eating the seeds and living off of this plant kind of quote unquote rent free, although, you know, pollination is pretty decent pay and rent, you know, this begs the question again, is like, how did this begin? So in your perspective, at least, or do you have hypotheses at this point as to what this chicken and an egg scenario, were they pollinators first, were they parasites first, and then it kind of just rolled on from there?
Yeah, I would bet on them being parasites first. And that essentially what happened is if they were feeding on the plants already, that the ones that also pollinated were probably a lot more successful.
Ah, okay. So there's probably a spectrum of behaviors there that then, you know, obviously it's pretty hard selection if you're eating all of the seeds of the plant you require.
Exactly. And yeah, yuccas have teeth too. So, I don't know if we want to get into this or not, but essentially the plants themselves have mechanisms to control the moths so they can prevent them from getting too numerous.
Yeah, let's get into that. That sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's cool because essentially I think most plants would probably have this mechanism. So it was probably built into the system from the beginning, but essentially yuccas make a lot of flowers. If you've ever seen them, that's part of the reason why they get planted in gardens, right? Is that they can have over 300 flowers on these tall inflorescences and they're really showy big plants. But the truth of the matter is while they have all those flowers, they can't keep all of them.
Okay.
So they're limited in terms of energy and often will drop upwards of 80% of the flowers.
Oh, whoa.
And so that means that plants can be choosy about which flowers they keep. So obviously they're going to not keep the ones that didn't get pollinated, but among the set that are pollinated, if there's a lot of damage in some flowers, they selectively drop those. And so they can actually detect the damage caused by yucca moth larvae feeding within the flowers and fruit. And selectively drop those. So if there are too many larvae, the plant says, nope, I'm going to get rid of that. And basically it kills all of the larvae within that. So there's fairly strong selection, I think, on the moths to you know, kind of hold back a little bit, not lay. Although I've seen females lay tons of eggs inside of flowers, but the ones that do that are probably not very successful.
Yeah, that's a pretty strong penalty to incur on this greedy moths.
Yeah, so spread your eggs out. Don't put them all in one basket or flower.
Yeah, the analogy applies. But, you know, from the moth's perspective, too, I mean, there's got to be some sort of signaling component to this to make sure that they're not laying. Well, you said one female can lay a ton of eggs, but I would assume that if one female lays eggs and then another female comes through, there's got to be ways for them to be able to tell if a flower is occupied or not, or do we not know that yet?
No, yeah. So let me back up and I'll tell you what a female does when she gets in a flower. So usually they run around the flowers. It looks sort of aimlessly, but they'll basically circle around the base. And, you know, we're not really sure what's going on, but sometimes during that circling behavior that they decide to move on to a new flower. And I'm suspicious that it's basically that they are finding or looking for scents of other females. And there's some evidence that suggests that females actually mark the flowers as they're laying eggs. So after the circling behavior, the next thing they do is they sort of position themselves so they can lay an egg into the flower. And as they do that, they wipe their abdomens along the pistil of the flower. And they'll lay an egg and then they'll keep wiping their abdomens. And actually my PhD advisor showed that flowers that had females basically abdominal extracts painted onto the flowers were less appealing to moths. So they didn't want to lay eggs into them as much as they did flowers that only had water painted on them.
Wow.
And so it suggests that they're laying down like basically a chemical trail that says, hey, I've been here.
Yeah. And again, this isn't altruistic behavior. This is literally just saying, like, my babies need all of this and they've got all of this, so just don't bother.
Right, exactly.
Or at least hypothetically speaking.
Yes. Wow. So if there are too many eggs, there'll be too many larvae and too much damage. And so that's really a strong natural selection on the moths against laying so many eggs.
Yeah, I probably should have looked this up before we started talking, but there's a lot of yucca species, or at least a good amount of them, especially in like the southern portions of North America here. Do they all do this?
Do they all have moths?
This pollination syndrome.
As far as we're aware, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's also a more distant relative, Hespero yucca, that has one species that does this too.
Really?
Yeah, that one's an unusual one. It's not the typical way. It has a different moth that actually all yucca moths are generally white in color. Mm-hmm. And that one actually has a yucca moth that's black or speckled, depending on where you go. And they're also diurnal moths on that one. It's very different. And I'm not sure, you know, what to make of it yet, but the flowers are different as well. So the pollination behaviors is at the same time. So,
but the fact that this is a shared trait then would suggest, at least to me, that this is something that probably arose early on in this lineage and has just kind of gone through diversification and changes as species change through time.
Exactly. And we're starting to realize there are sort of nuanced differences in the pollination behavior itself. And there are definitely big differences in how and where the females lay eggs in the flowers, depending on what species of yucca is being used and what species of moth you're looking at.
So what are some of these nuances then that kind of suggests, you know, sort of independent diversification of this system?
So we have, and I guess you can categorize the moths in terms of how they lay their eggs, is there's one superficial way that they can do that, where they just kind of dig a small pit in the tissue surface and leave an egg right there. And you can see it actually just sticking out of the surface of the tissue of the flower. Mm-hmm. But most of the moths are actually what we would call locule ovipositing species. So they lay eggs that are essentially placed right next to the seeds. So they're buried inside the flower, and that seems to me like a better strategy because they're more protected.
Right.
The superficial species, they have problems. So I'll say that a lot of those eggs die, and it's at a much higher rate. And I think the reason that might have evolved is because of this plant defense, in the sense that when females lay eggs inside of the flowers, they're damaging seeds and basically allowing the plant to register the damage, and then flowers, you know, can be dropped from the plants if there are too many eggs laid and too many larvae feeding.
Right.
In a superficial circumstance, the plants can't really detect that damage, and so the females can get away with laying a lot of eggs.
Hmm.
Whether that was a mechanism that allowed the insects to diversify is, you know, up for debate, but I think that it may have helped at least.
Yeah. It is really curious to think of, you know, sort of the signaling pathways involved in a plant. This is very similar to some of the anti-herbivory signaling, at least letting a plant know something's been munching on it and there's damaged parts to deal with. But on some level, there has to be this threshold, right? Because otherwise it would penalize too many, and then the pollination services would drop off. Is there sort of a magic number, or is that completely nebulous at this point?
A magic number? How many eggs can you take?
Yeah.
Yeah, the number is 12.
Oh, whoa, really?
Yeah, believe it or not, I can tell you that, yes.
Oh, so, that's awesome.
Approximately 12.
I did not expect to hear a concise, accurate number there.
Yeah, 12 is a lot, actually, but some of those eggs don't live, so.
Yeah.
That usually amounts to less.
So this, again, I mean, these are two species that desperately need each other, and it seems like, you know, this moth's entire life cycle is cued around the short flowering period, and then the larvae obviously live a longer life than the adults in most lepidopterans. But how long does this whole process take? Is it one season? Do they overwinter? What's it like?
Oh, there's another fun story. Oh. Well, so the moths complete their larval life cycle in the fruit. And then once they're done eating, they drop out of the fruit and then overwinter underground. So they actually dig down into the soil. It's kind of a magic happens. We're not really sure exactly, because no one's been able to actually, you know, you can sift through the soil underneath the plants, but finding the larvae there is very challenging. So we've actually done some lab experiments where we keep them in what we call rearing chambers, which is just a fancy word for a paint can, a 1 gallon paint can.
Nice.
We put them in soil in these cans, and then we close up the cans and bury them at our research garden here on campus. And the next year we can dig up those cans, and then they'll emerge about the same time that the plants flower here.
Wow.
So the consequence of having done this experiment where I essentially, let's see, in 2006 and 2007, we buried a set of cans with larvae that we have not since added to. And we had moths come out from those cans last year.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and then we're waiting, anxiously awaiting to see if we'll have a moth come out this year from those. But essentially, they've been trickling out over time. So they could complete their life cycle and become an adult in 1 year. But it looks like they could wait many, many years.
Huh.
So there's like a seed bank, right? So we can call it the moth seed bank of sorts that's sitting out there in the soil.
Yeah. And that kind of bleeds into another question I have with considering the specificity of this mutualism and the idea that our climate is changing extremely rapidly, and this means that both organisms have to find suitable habitat in order to prosper. And it's more than just breeding, obviously. It's climate, it's microclimate, humidity, all that stuff. So it would seem like if, you know, one partner gets messed up, the other partner is screwed. But what you just described here is there's some sort of like, I don't know if you want to call it an adaptation, but there's like an insurance policy built in with the moths that if yuccas don't flower at the same time or don't flower that year, they're not wasting all of their reproductive effort in one swoop.
Right. So having this staggered emergence of moths is probably really helpful in particularly the deserts of like the Southwest, right? So yeah. Some years yuccas don't flower at all and the moths that come out are doomed. But if only a proportion of those come out, then that means that in the following years that more moths can trickle out and at least a female's lineage might be assured.
Dang, that's pretty wild. And what are the male moths doing throughout this? I mean, they're just literally just sperm cases to deliver seed.
In essence, yes, they hang out in the flowers and harass females.
Typical.
Yes, it's funny. The moths are they don't like to spend time anywhere else. They don't spend time on any other vegetation. They sit in those flowers all day, and then wait for nighttime to fall when they mate and or lay eggs and pollinate.
So at least it makes finding them a little bit easier, I'd assume.
Yes, and I think that the floral scent is probably an important cue that helps them mate. Actually, that's part of the ritual, if you will.
Yeah. But, I mean, obviously, like, something like a Joshua tree is spread over a large landscape. I honestly don't frequent many places where yucca are native, but I would assume that spending all of your time and all of your offspring's time around a population would get genetically sort of isolated, or at least reduce some of that genetic diversity, but that could also breed in a lot of, like, the mechanisms that make evolution possible. Is there evidence for that sort of? You know, a yucca population gets established over here, maybe its phenology is different, and then the moths, through some long-distance dispersal, find it, and then they get sort of isolated. Is there any evidence of that throughout this lineage?
Yeah, so what you're describing is allopatric speciation, and we think that a lot of the plants, at least, have become new species just through geographic isolation. The moths definitely can disperse long distances, and we've seen that in the eastern United States, actually, where Yucca filamentosa is native to the southeastern United States and has a pretty broad range. But we believe that humans actually transplanted them up here where I live, actually. We live in Syracuse. So they have a much broader range. The plants have expanded northward. And most of the time when you find them, they're in cemeteries and people's yards, you know, that kind of thing. But the moths have followed. And I wonder now if the moths that have expanded onto these plants aren't actually becoming isolated. We don't have clear evidence of that yet.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, obviously there's always more questions to ask on the horizon, but that's extremely cool because in thinking about the specificity of this, and like I think you might have mentioned earlier, there's no pollination without these moths. And I used to live in New York. Yuccas got pollinated there. I now live in central Illinois, where they're also not native. Yuccas are still getting pollinated here. So exactly. That is purely because the moths have been able to relocate with them.
Yeah, so they're probably really great flyers. I've seen them take off. I've done a lot of nighttime observations of these guys, and you'll be watching a moth doing her business on a plant. And then for whatever reason, she decides to move on, and she's up in the air column and gone. Yeah. It's amazing.
And that's also amazing just because, again, this is such a specific relationship, but it seems extremely flexible because, you know, the phenology and just the way a plant grows, say, in Syracuse versus Florida is going to be radically different. But here we have a case where the mutualists stuck together.
Exactly. I think the plants would do fairly well for a long time on their own, though. They can reproduce asexually through underground rhizomes and basically just wait their moths out. I mean, they live a long time, right?
Right.
Yuccas are hundreds of years, possibly.
Wow. Even the ones in our garden, huh?
Probably, yes.
That's incredible. But it's cool to think about that. I mean, you get a single colonization event or maybe a handful of colonization events, whether that's intentional, you know, with the hands of human or if it was a long distance seed dispersal event. But here's a plant that can persist vegetatively, grow its numbers, despite, you know, the fact that it's a clone, until said mutualist does or does not arrive. I mean, this is something that could potentially go on for centuries or more until the right set of circumstances bring them two back together.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that difference in life cycle, you know, the generation times could really help out.
That's so cool. And now you mentioned a couple species of moths are doing this. I mean, are they close enough related, but other than where they lay their eggs on the plant, I mean, is it they all sort of converged on the similar strategy of having specialized mouth parts to pick up the pollen, deposit it, and then lay the eggs and wait it, you know, it's all kind of converged very similarly?
Yeah, I think that likely what's happened is that the habit of pollination, of being a pollinator for these guys, evolved once in the ancestor of all these, and then they diversified after. And actually, we also have what might be at least three instances in which the moths have lost the ability to be pollinators.
Oh?
Yeah, they're called cheaters.
Interesting. And where does that come into play?
Cheaters are moths that instead of pollinating, what they do is they wait until the plant has developing fruit and then they go in and they lay eggs. And so the plant's already committed to developing those fruit. It's past the time when they would normally drop them.
Oh.
And so that's why we call them cheaters, because they don't give anything to the plant and they're purely parasites. They're laying eggs inside those fruit and the larvae are feeding on seeds that would have been intact for the plant. They would have... potentially little plants.
That is wild. So you have this instance where we assume starts as a parasite, comes into this perfect mutualistic relationship, and then evolves back to being a parasite. That is such a prime example of what we call the evolutionary arms race, this give and take of trying to get as much with giving as little in return.
Exactly. So why those moths switched to being purely cheaters, we don't know. They actually, they can't pollinate because they don't have those specialized mouth parts anymore. And their behaviors have shifted. So why would you do that as a moth? Well, maybe it costs time to collect pollen, or maybe you can't fly as far if you're carrying pollen, if it's heavy. I mean, they can carry a lot of pollen. It's bigger than their head, usually.
That's pretty wild.
And so, you know, if you can reduce your costs as a moth and still gain the benefits of having someplace for your offspring to feed, then why not?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even if it's a slight benefit.
Yeah. What's surprising to me is that the pollinators exist at all.
Right.
If that's true, right? But those cheater moths are dependent upon the pollinators. So they're also, you know, tied up with all of this. This obligate mutualism.
Yeah, I was going to say that really complicates issues when you're also reliant on quote-unquote non-cheating or behaving moths on top of it.
So you have to depend on both a plant and another moth to do your work for you, and then you can come in.
Jeez, that's pretty intense. And it's really easy to see why, among other things, this system has captured your attention to some degree. But what I love about your work is it tells us so much about evolutionary relationships. It tells us so much about, you know, this parasite becomes mutualist sort of relationship. But then it also gives us insights into how these extremely strict mutualisms can evolve and behave in this big natural experiment that is climate change, because again, you've got people moving plants around, the moths have followed and kept up, and then you get to see how all of this plays out. There's so many different applications for your work.
Thank you. Yeah, I have enjoyed very much working on these guys.
Yeah, and it's so cool that, you know, you can be in Syracuse and study this system either in a greenhouse or in, you know, your garden, potentially.
Yes, yes, we have brought them all here to us.
That's very cool. So, I mean, what's on the horizon with this work? What are you thinking about in you know, the next few years in terms of questions and things you'd like to answer?
Yeah, well, we're hoping to understand more about whether it's being a parasite or being a good pollinator that makes the moths diversify. And so far, it looks like actually being a parasite is going to probably be the answer. We have good evidence now that the moths can easily pollinate species they've never, ever encountered before and never would encounter in their lifetimes.
Oh.
But when you ask if they can also be good parasites of those plants, usually the answer is no.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's, we're trying to figure out, and hopefully this summer we'll be able to work out a method to be able to do so. But essentially what we want to do is feed yucca moth larvae different species of yucca seeds and see if it's the seeds, essentially. So yuccas are pretty well-defended plants. They have saponins in them, which is a soapy compound. Mm. It's something that Native Americans actually took advantage of. So you can make soaps out of these, or, you know, if you have a upset stomach, you know, you can always eat a little yucca and that might help clear you out at least. But for the moths, I think it might be bad news. So, you know, they might be locally adapted to the chemical site, essentially, that are within their native plant. But if you put them on a non-natal plant, then I am suspicious that the chemistry might be affecting them. So we're hoping to test ideas about that. Like, what is limiting the ability of a moth to parasitize other species of yucca?
Yeah. That's a fascinating question in and of itself. I'm really looking forward to whatever you find out there.
Yeah, we've got, actually, there are undergrads in my lab right now trying to extract saponins out of yuccas.
Ooh, good luck.
Yeah, no, it's working out pretty well. I'm excited, but nice. We don't have the data yet, so I can't answer the question about, you know, how different the chemistry is.
Yeah, but that's what keeps this all so very exciting, is it's like, okay, what's next year going to turn out for us?
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I'm still baffled by the also the evolution of the cheaters and how that came about without completely destabilizing the mutualism itself. Right. You know, if a pollinator moth becomes a cheater, there's nobody around to pollinate anymore. Right.
Right.
So why doesn't the mutualism just break down and everybody go locally extinct? And how did it come about with these cheater species that we have? Ooh. So. And I've just recently discovered a new cheater species that I'm pretty excited about.
Wait, really? As in, like, new to science or new to the system?
New to science, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Where about?
It lives in the Southwest, and it's a cheater that has a humongous ovipositor or egg-laying device, and it basically uses these fully developed yucca fruit. And what we thought was one species that used multiple species of yuccas is actually going to probably end up to be, well, it is going to end up to be two species at least that actually specialize a bit more.
Excellent.
So it's like every time we find these generalists, if you look a little bit closer, then we start to realize that, oh, actually that's more than one thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, just the amount of layers to unpack here and to try to figure out. I mean, it's super interesting, extremely challenging in some ways, but I'd imagine it's like that fun challenge of what is it, what can we find, where's that smoking gun, so to speak. But just the level of questions, again, you can ask across multiple different avenues of scientific thinking and theories.
Yeah, that's a neat thing about studying species interactions, is that you can flip it around and look at both sides, right? Yeah. You know, so sometimes I focus more on the moths, and then other times, like another project that we're thinking about is understanding basically species boundaries in a group of yuccas that live in Texas. So they all have very close ranges. Essentially, the species ranges abut one another. And we're trying to understand if the moths could fly across that boundary, what's maintaining species boundaries in the plants. And so we've been doing crosses in our garden here on campus. And we're trying to sort out what's going on there. And initially, at least, it looks like they can hybridize. So we don't really, it's kind of a mystery since they overlap in flowering time and all this, that There should be opportunities for them to hybridize in the field, but they don't. So that's also on the horizon. I don't know if that'll go anywhere, but I think it's interesting.
Yeah, that is super interesting because, like you mentioned earlier, and as we just talked about just now, is these species boundaries between yuccas, whether it's in something that breaks down easily or not in nature, are pretty fluid, and hybridization is extremely viable and possible. But again, if you completely rely on a single species of mutualist for pollination, and that really dictates where pollen is going, you know, that adds a whole new layer to yucca diversity.
Yeah, although, you know, these moths, they only have a couple of neurons, and just, I always wonder, I'm like, are they smart enough to figure out that they're on the wrong plant? Because they aren't when they're up here in our garden, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm like, how does it work in Texas? There's something special going on there.
Right. What's really going on upstairs with these little buggers? Fascinating. Yeah, I can see why this research has really attracted your attention. This is more complex than I realized. And that's awesome. So in thinking about all of this, obviously you're looking at a lot of different yuccas. This is a plant podcast. Do you have a favorite species or group of yuccas or place to study yuccas that you can think of?
I think my favorite yucca is Yucca harmonii. It lives in Utah, and it's the tiniest of all yuccas, I think. It's a cute little pincushion that could be maybe, I don't know, the big ones might be 8 inches across.
Oh, jeez. All right, that appeals to me.
Yeah, I've always wanted to work more with that plant. I haven't yet, but yeah, I think it's my favorite.
Nice. Well, there you go. You just pitch it as, what are the little ones doing?
What are the little ones doing? I mean, yuccas are keystone species in deserts, right? They're charismatic. They're huge usually, but this little guy, I don't know, just appeals to me somehow.
Yeah, you're speaking my language too, but... It is funny to think of all the attention yuccas have gotten over, you know, unfortunate attention because of all the Joshua tree issues that were going on. But, you know, there's more than one reason to care about these plants, and just the fact that they can teach us so much and are doing such amazing things with their pollinators. I mean, I think you've just really woken us up to the world of yuccas, pollination, and really strange mutualism, parasitism. So if people want to dive in deeper, learn more about your work and what your lab is doing, how do you recommend they find you?
My website is a good way to start. It's seagraveslab.syr.edu.
Excellent. And I will put up links to that on the show notes for this episode. But Dr. Seagraves, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Yeah, of course. You're welcome back anytime. So do keep in touch with all the cool updates that are coming out of your lab.
All right, I will.
All right, have a good one.
Thanks.
Cheers. Mutualisms are fascinating, aren't they? I thank Dr. Seagraves for taking time out of her busy schedule to talk to us about this incredible research. I know after listening to this, I'm going to be harassing every yucca in my neighborhood to look and see if any of those moths are around there. But it is really interesting to know that this research can apply to understanding how mutualisms can change across climate and resource gradients. It's really important work when you think about what's going on with climate change and how all of our planting zones and all of that is going to shift as our climate shift. And of course, you can find all of the links and relevant information on the show notes for this episode. Just go over to indefensiveplants.com/podcast and navigate to this particular episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it, and I couldn't be doing it without you. If you want to support this podcast in any way, consider a couple things. One being patreon.com/indefensiveplants. Consider becoming a patron over there. You can also donate to Indefensive Plants. Any amount is welcome. Just head on over to indefensiveplants.com and look down on the right-hand side of the page for that donate button. And if money isn't your thing, which I completely understand, at the very least consider reviewing this podcast on whatever pod portal you use to download it. Finally, we have plenty of merch for sale, indefensiveplants.com/shop and teespring.com/stores/indefensiveplants. As always, so many good things on the horizon, so keep checking back in, and the best way to do that is to hit that subscribe button. But until next week, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.